Good day, and welcome to the Unilateral Conduct in the Pharmaceutical Sector conference call. Today's conference is being recorded. At this time, I would like to turn the conference over to your host today, Mr. Randy Treitel. Please go ahead, sir.
Thank you. Welcome. I am Randy Treitel from the U.S. Federal Trade Commission, and it's my pleasure to welcome you today to the ICN's Unilateral Conduct Working Group's teleseminar on unilateral conduct in the pharmaceutical industry. I'd like to thank everybody for joining. I'd like to get us right to the program, but I'm just going to say a brief word about our teleseminars program, and then I'll turn it over to my co-chair, Markus Lange, of Germany's Bundeskartellamt. This is the working group's third teleseminar. We have found teleseminars to provide a useful and flexible means to share perspectives among ICN members and NGAs about different aspects of unilateral conduct analysis and policy and how they have been dealt with by agencies and courts around the world. Following our first programs on excessive pricing and remedies, this is the first to examine unilateral conduct issues on a sectoral basis. With all the interesting cases and issues in the pharmaceutical sector today, we hope that you'll find this to be an interesting and valuable discussion. We hope that through our discussion, you'll emerge with a better understanding of the issues, of alternative ways to approaching them, and perhaps some further questions and ideas regarding our own policies in the area of unilateral conduct in the pharmaceutical sector. We're going to begin with an overview of the issues, and then speakers from South Africa, the United Kingdom, and the United States are going to present several case studies and invite discussion by members and non-governmental advisors. Note that your lines are now muted, but we'll open the floor for comments and questions following the overview presentation and after the case studies. And I encourage you to ask questions, share your perspectives, and add to the discussion. We're going to conduct today's seminar as a webinar also, meaning that you can also follow the program through slides online in real time. To do that, click on one of the links in the email sent yesterday from the ICN Secretariat. That email also included a slide deck, which is also posted on the ICN website on the Unilateral Conduct Working Group's homepage. Now, I understand there have been several technical issues with some hookups to the webinar, and we're working on that and hope to resolve them shortly. So with that, it's my pleasure to turn the program over to today's moderator, Markus Lange, who heads the international unit of the Bundeskartellamt. Markus?
Thank you very much, Randy. Let me turn to today's topic, which is the pharmaceutical industry and unilateral conduct issues in this industry. Total global expenditure for health amounts to more than $4,000 billion annually. A substantial part of this sum is spent on medicines. In 2007, for example, the market for prescription and non-prescription medicines for human use was worth over €214 billion in the EU alone. This makes pharmaceuticals a key sector of our economies. The pharmaceutical sector has one of the highest investments in R&D. Innovation is of paramount importance in this field. Innovative drugs have enabled patients to benefit from treatments that were unimaginable a few decades ago and have provided dramatic improvements in quality of life. The search for adequate treatment for many diseases drives the innovative efforts for new medicines. At the same time, however, public budgets are under severe strain, and this does not leave health expenditures unaffected. In an economic sector of this size and importance, and with the constraints it faces, competition issues play, of course, a key role. After all, competition is the mechanism that may keep rising health costs under some control. Among the competition issues in this sector, unilateral conduct has a particular role to play. The pharmaceutical sector shows a specific combination of narrow relevant markets and the extensive use of IP rights. This makes for the strong market positions of many pharmaceutical companies. One of the challenges in the pharmaceutical sector is to balance the need for protecting innovation with the openness and competitivity of markets. So some of the questions are, how much protection should be afforded to originator companies to encourage them to develop new drugs at the cost of restricting access to the market? And how does this relate to the dynamic development of markets? The pharmaceutical sector is in the focus of attention of many competition authorities around the world. This is evidenced by the high-profile roundtables, by sector inquiries, and by market studies that are done throughout the world on the sector. So today's seminar is a timely one, and I'm sure it will also be an interesting and a thought-provoking exercise for all of us. Let me now introduce our expert panel that will discuss some of the issues that come up in the enforcement of unilateral conduct rules in the pharmaceuticals. I will be very brief in my presentations. More extensive information on the members of our distinguished panel is contained in the slide deck that accompanies our session. I would first like to introduce Satish Sule, who is with DG Competition of the European Commission. Satish is an expert in the unit dealing with pharma issues. We have Scott Hemphill with us, who is a professor of law at Columbia Law School. Scott's research and teaching focuses on the balance between innovation and competition set by antitrust law. With us is Jean-Paul Brankin, who is a lawyer with Crowell & Mooring in Brussels. Jean-Paul has represented generic industry clients in the context of the European Commission's pharmaceuticals sector inquiry. We have Liberty Nkuba with us, who is a senior analyst in the Policy and Research Division of the Competition Commission of South Africa. We have Ed Smith, who heads the international team at the OFT in the United Kingdom, and who was involved as a case officer in various cases related to the pharmaceutical sector. We have Natalie Timmel with us, who is a senior economist working in the economic policy team of the OFT, inter alia providing economic input into policy discussions. And we have Brad Albert on our panel, who is the Deputy Assistant Director of the Healthcare Division of the United States Federal Trade Commission. Brad has been involved in many of the FTC's major pharmaceutical initiatives. Welcome to the members of our panel. Thank you very much for being with us and participating in our session, giving your very expert input to our discussion on the pharmaceutical sector. Now, I would like to turn to Satish and ask Satish to give his presentation. An overview of antitrust enforcement in the pharmaceutical sector from the European Commission's perspective. Satish, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Marcus, and thanks to Marcus, Randy, and Jan for inviting me to speak on this topic today. I'm trying to give an overview on unilateral practices in the pharmaceutical sector. As Marcus already indicated, this is very much a EU perspective, and a lot also is based on observations that the European Commission made during the sector inquiry in 2008 and 2009. In most legal regimes of competition law, infringements by unilateral practices are dependent on significant market power and of that infringing party. In order to assess market power in a given market, it is thus necessary to clearly define the market concerned. And in my introductory overview, I would like to look at market definition questions, in particular the traditional approach, as well as potential implications of the AstraZeneca judgment that was handed down by the General Court this summer, and to see whether that changes anything. Although I will be relatively brief on that and focus more on the unilateral practices, as I understand that that Jean-Paul will actually look at this also perhaps in a bit more detail. As far as the unilateral practices are concerned, I would in particular give an overview on the practices observed by the European Commission in its sector inquiry 2008-2009, but also speak about the practices that were challenged by the European Union's Commission's decision against AstraZeneca in 2005, which has been largely confirmed by the General Court by the decision of July this year. Now, turning to market definition, the traditional approach, one would say, certainly in the within the Commission, but probably in several other jurisdictions as well, is to focus on substitutability of the products that are concerned, mostly by looking at the characteristics of a product, at prices, and the intended use of those products. As regards pharmaceuticals, the relevant market for a long time used to be, or let us say the starting point rather to assess what the market is, used to be the ATC3 level, which means the third level of the anatomic therapeutic classification system, in particular in antitrust and merger cases. This does not, however, mean that it's not possible to move to a narrower market or a wider, depending on the individual circumstances of the case. And in fact, in the AstraZeneca decision of the European Commission, the Commission departed from the ATC3 level, included also several aspects in defining the market which were criticized by the industry and, of course, by the company concerned. However, it's interesting to note that the General Court supported the conclusion on market definition here. In particular, it did accept certain tests. Well, first of all, it did accept that the market was a narrow market, namely ATC4, and that the products concerned here, we're talking about PPIs, proton pump inhibitors, which were revolutionary considered to be revolutionary by the Commission at the time when they entered the market, that they were a class of their own and that they were not actually restrained by so-called H2 blockers that had been on the market for a longer time. The court agreed with that, in particular when looking at the different modes of action, the greater efficacy of PPIs, and also the resulting different therapeutic uses that they were put to. The court, interestingly, also accepted a certain tests run by the Commission, certain events analysis, price indicators as well, even though we are talking about a market here that is quite regulated as far as price is concerned in the individual member states, but also aspects such as asymmetrical substitution. So this was an interesting point, it showed that individual circumstances, as the ones that we had in this particular case, allowed to move away from the ATC3 starting point and really look at what the circumstances are in the particular case. Now, turning to I have to point out that this was a decision by the General Court and it is currently under appeal, so there will be another decision by the European Court of Justice, but that will probably still take some time. Now, turning to the sector inquiry of the European Commission, this was an inquiry carried out because there were indications of delay of generic entry and a decline in innovation, and it's an inquiry that was started in 2008 and concluded in the summer of 2009. During this inquiry, a number of questionnaires were sent out to the stakeholders, in particular to originator and generic companies. There were inspections carried out at companies' premises, actually upfront inspections at the time. And the following, I would like to point out the following unilateral practices that we looked at or that were actually observed. They involve patenting strategies, in particular on patent clusters, creating patent clusters and defensive patenting, patent disputes and oppositions that lead to certain litigation procedures, interventions by originator companies before national authorities to delay generic entry, and life cycle management, what's sometimes also referred to as product hopping or evergreening. Now, these practices as such are, of course, not necessarily anti-competitive, but they may be, depending on the individual circumstances of the case. And have a bit more of a look at it now. If you, I don't know if you can see slide 17, where you can see a graph that shows patent clusters. Up to 90 patent families were noted to be registered for one blockbuster medicine. Now, that's within the European system, that can translate into 1,300 national and EPO patents and applications, which for a generic company may be quite an important factor, because if you want to launch a product European-wide, then you would have to face all these individual patents. There was also the problem of divisional patents that can be split out from an original patent application, which do not prolong the patent, but they can prolong the uncertainty of whether the patent will be granted or not. So you might have challenged successfully the parent patent, but the divisional will still be in examination limbo, so to say. So you will not have legal certainty on that. When you look at this graph, what you can see is that at the end of the graph, you have the total number of patents that would protect a particular product. The interesting point is that a substantial amount of those patents were actually filed after the launch of this product. Now, turning to litigation, just a few words on litigation and opposition. Opposition procedures can be brought before the European Patent Office once a patent is granted. And here it was interesting to see that the opposition rate for those pharmaceutical patents was higher than in other sectors. And in 60% of the cases, it did lead to revocation of the patent. However, 80% of the procedures took more than 2 years. Now, the 60% of cases that were led to revocation were usually then brought by the generic companies that thought that there was no no innovative step, for example, or novelty was not present in the particular cases. As far as litigation is concerned, which is then carried out later on at the national level, the average duration here to reach a final outcome was 2.8 years, and in this case, generic companies won 62% of the litigation cases. Now, when we turn to interventions, unfortunately, we couldn't include the image to show this a bit clearer, but it would show that originator companies intervened at different national authorities in order to delay generic medicines, the entry of generic medicines. For example, at marketing authorization bodies, but also at pricing and reimbursement authorities. The reasons that were mentioned then were that the generic medicines were not safe or were not biologically equivalent, and also that they infringed a patent. Now, this a kind of patent linkage, according to European law, is not allowed to be raised as a point before the marketing authorization, which is an interesting fact to note here. When we turn to life cycle strategies, we found out that 40% of the medicines in our sample were actually showed that there were second-generation products launched. You see here in slide 20 some of the quotes that we found. In particular, one original company said, "Our second-generation product represents the most effective initiative to counter generic versions of the first-generation product." What is interesting in this context, and what originator as well as generic companies agreed upon, was that if a company manages to switch its patient base from the first generation product to the second generation product before a generic version of the first generation product enters the market, then the market's basically gone for generic companies. And if they don't, then the originator company said it will be very difficult to switch patients that have been lost to the generic versions of the first version to a follow-on medicine. As far as life cycle is concerned, I would like to add at this point, life cycle or product hopping from our point of view in itself is not cannot be an infringement of competition law. However, it would depend on the individual circumstances if certain tactics or strategies are used in order to keep out generic products at the essential time where you need to switch a patient base to a second generation product, then that may very well be an infringement of competition law rules. Now, just a few words on AstraZeneca. There were two practices that were challenged by the European Commission. Here we had, first, the submission of misleading information to patent officers in order to obtain a prolonged exclusivity. This is something that you can obtain within the European Union, the so-called SPC, Supplementary Protection Certificate, in order to make up for time that innovative companies lost at the time of marketing authorization when bringing the their innovative product to the market. Now, this is very much dependent on the dates when the product was first launched in the European Union. The Commission held that, in this case, the wrong dates had been communicated to the patent officers, which resulted in extra exclusivity periods of several months. In the Commission, in the decision by the General Court, it's interesting to note that the Court supported the Commission's view, and in particular, you see the quote in slide 21. It was interesting to note, as it held, that the submission to the public authorities of misleading information liable to lead them into error and therefore to make possible the grant of an exclusive right to which it an undertaking is not entitled is falling outside the scope of competition and merits. Now, that is an interesting and strong statement, and it's interesting to see whether this will be upheld by the European Court of Justice, but it shows that a certain misuse of governmental procedures and systems such as the patent system may very well lead to an infringement of competition law rules. Having a look at the second abuse in the AstraZeneca case, here we have a deregistration and withdrawal of the marketing authorization of the Losec capsules, the proton pump inhibitor, the first generation product, from the market, and them being replaced by a different form, by tablets namely. And the aim was the following, to actually raise legal barriers to enter the market for generic versions. The reason being that at the time, any generic medicine would need as a reference an authorized originator product on the market. So with deregistration of the marketing authorization, that condition could no longer be fulfilled and generics were precluded from entering the market. Although it is interesting to note in this context, it's actually the deregistration of the marketing authorization, not the withdrawal of the capsules as such from the market that were held to be a competition law infringement. Now, finally, just to sum up, I would say a few words on relationship between the IPRs and antitrust law, although Marcus has already said something about it. There are these perceived tensions between exclusive rights that are meant to protect innovation and, on the other hand, effective competition. But it is interesting to note that the EU Commission, as well as, for example, the FTC, have always pointed out that both systems have as their aim the promotion of innovation and of consumer welfare. So it is not just a tension between these two bodies of law from our point of view. And obviously, IPRs are indispensable for dynamic competition. The Commission, at no point within the within the sector inquiry, put that into question. It does, on the other hand, not mean that a misuse of the system would be immune from competition law intervention and scrutiny. Obviously, we would not, and that is, of course, can be a difficult area to look at. The aim is not that of the competition authority to substitute any patent officers and to start evaluating concrete patents. It's rather exceptional circumstances in the individual case that would show whether there's a competition infringement or not. Turning to cases, all I can say at this point, with AstraZeneca having been the first major case in the pharmaceutical sector showing such an infringement, We have currently opened two proceedings in the case of perindopril and citalopram, namely cases against the companies Servier and Lundbeck that include possibly unilateral practices. But unfortunately, as they are ongoing cases, I cannot say anything more about this at this point. But thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you very much, Satish, for this very illuminating overview and outline of the European perspective on antitrust in the pharmaceutical sector, a perspective that Jean-Paul is going to broaden now. I'd like to give the floor over to Jean-Paul now.
Okay, thanks, Marcus, and thanks, Satish. I think we should be on slide 24 now, and since time is getting on, why don't we skip straight over from that introductory slide onto my first substantive slide, slide 25. Now, I was asked to give some comments and thoughts in response to Satish's very interesting presentation. In order to do that in a rounded way, I thought it was worth stepping back for a moment and taking note of the peculiarities of the pharmaceutical market, indeed of the sector generally. And I think two are particularly important here. And the first is the fact that pharmaceutical markets really are innovation-driven. The development of new drugs is central to consumer benefits and industry profitability, and it's the driver for R&D. So innovation is both central in terms of the commercial strategy of firms, but also in terms of driving the consumer benefits, which are, you know, the focus of all of us in terms of setting competition policy. And that's recognized, rewarded, and incentivized through the patent system. I'll come back to that in a second. Now, the second factor that I wanted to highlight here was that demand structures in this area and in these markets are very unusual. Drugs are prescribed by doctors, taken and used by patients, and at least in Europe, they're typically paid for by health systems. So you have a divide between the decision maker who decides which drug to administer, the person who takes the drug, and the person who pays for it at the end of the day. And that means that pricing pressure, which might lead to switching between drugs or between products in other sectors, doesn't operate in quite the same way here. The doctors who are the decision makers have that pricing pressure taken off them by the support they receive through the health systems, and it's the users that ultimately take the drugs in the first place. So those two factors lead to, I think, two things that are worth bearing in mind. First of all, that the whole sector is vulnerable in a quite unusual way to the chilling effects on innovation that might come with over-enthusiastic enforcement, particularly of competition law in relation to unilateral practices. And secondly, that because of this lack of pricing pressure, there's a tendency towards rather narrower markets than usual. So you may have both a greater opportunity to intervene in terms of unilateral conduct because you have these narrow markets where there are maybe market power, and a greater sensitivity to intervention. And if we go to the next slide, that sort of illustrates the way that's playing out, at least in terms of market definition, under European law. In the AstraZeneca case, the General Court focused very much on therapeutic use and the prescribing practices of doctors in terms of defining markets. So markets were defined as on the basis of whether doctors were seeing drugs as substitutes for one for the other. And although the court recognized that the peculiarities of the sector meant that there would be less pricing pressure on those decisions than usual, and that would limit the extent of price competition, they didn't feel that in any way meant that a different approach to market definition was appropriate. They merely noted that you were likely, if you pursue market definition in a normal way, to end up with narrower markets than usual. And there's been similar observations in recent merger cases by the Commission. So let's move on to the last slide and have a look at what kind of implications that might have in terms of pursuing infringement. And, you know, in Europe, this is normally thought of in terms of abuse of dominance. Well, I think care needs to be taken in terms of which infringements are pursued, because they can have different effects in terms of the risk they have on chilling innovation. And I've tried to class some of the abuses that we've heard talked about into two categories, the first of which is those which may have a more limited risk of chilling innovation. And that's things like monopolization by deception, making misleading patent applications in the way that's covered by the first AstraZeneca abuse described by Satish. Part of that first abuse was also litigating on the basis of misleading representations. And again, that's covered by that first abuse. And there, the chilling effect that you risk is as much as anything chilling effects on deception and misleading conduct, as long as you define that appropriately and narrowly, rather than chilling on innovation. And similarly with the types of intervention in relation to national authorization authorities that Satish was talking about, as long as you can identify misleading or inappropriate interventions, that's what you'll be chilling, not innovation. Abuse of processes is the second abuse in AstraZeneca. The idea was to focus on behavior which wasn't market behavior and where the sole purpose was clearly to frustrate generic entry. And again, if you can chill that, then innovation is perhaps less of a threat than might be otherwise. And the third category is infringements in relation to patents that aren't covered by the patent process, that aren't covered by patent protection any longer. And again, that reduces the risk of chilling innovation. But if we look at other infringements, and these are things that Satish has mentioned, then there's potential for more controversy. So when we think about patent clusters and blocking patents, then where we go outside the area of patents which have no fundamental justification because they've been acquired on the basis of deception, there's a clear risk of chilling innovation. If we talk about life cycle management or evergreening in relation to patented products, and it's typically the follow-on product that remains patented, again, you've got that risk. Refusals to license at prior and excessive pricing both raise the same kinds of concerns more obviously. Now, I know that we're short of time, and I think I may have overrun short of time already, so I'll hand over.
Thank you very much, Jean-Paul, for broadening our view of the perspective beyond the agency view and giving the view from private practice. I would now like to hand over to Scott, who will give some additional observations from an American perspective. Scott, the floor is yours.
Terrific. Thanks again to the organizers for the opportunity to join you all today. So as was mentioned, Satish discussed some of the results from the European sector inquiry and the investigations that have resulted from that. And so I want to offer just a few initial results from an analogous inquiry of U.S. drug patenting practices that I'm undertaking with Bhavin Sampat, a colleague here at Columbia in the Public Health School, and why some of those results might matter for what we are thinking about today. So the basic result, and we're on slide 29 now, is that we're seeing a lot of the same trends as those that were reported in the sector inquiry. So the chart that you're staring at shows the number of patents per drug organized a little bit differently from the inquiry. It's done by approval cohort. So, if you look at the bottom of the slide, 1985 to 1987, those would be drugs approved between those years. So, for example, Losec or Prilosec approved in 1989 would be in that second set, and Nexium, its next generation drug, would be in the last cohort. So bear in mind that I'm not doing this by active ingredient. I'm doing this by drug approval. So second-generation drugs are considered as being distinct from the first-generation drugs, and that this is a narrow measure of patenting. So we don't get nearly up to 90 different patent families. These are individual patents that are listed in our U.S. Orange Book, which tend to be the most relevant patents protecting a drug. So the basic message that you can see here is pretty clear. The average number of patents per drug is increasing steadily from about 2 patents per drug in the first cohort to 4 patents per drug in the last cohort. And if we look at the second panel of the same slide, nominal patent life, that tells a similar story. By nominal patent life, I mean the number of years from the date of market entry by the brand name drug out to the expiration of the last expiring patent. And so here we see a pretty significant trend from an average of 14 years of nominal patent protection to about 16 years in the last cohort. And I should add, much as in the European context, we also observe a significant amount of post-launch patenting, which is some evidence that not all of these patents are created equal. So this increase in patenting activity has a counterpart, and if we could go to the next slide, which is increasing patent challenges by generic firms. So now we're looking at slide 30, and what this slide depicts is the share of drugs within a cohort that receives a paragraph 4 challenge, which I'll define in just a moment. This is the dashed line or the red line. So what I have in mind here is that in the U.S., generic drug makers frequently challenge the patents of brand name drug makers in order to try to get their products to market sooner. That's what we call in the U.S. paragraph 4 challenges. I think Brad Albert will probably discuss some of these challenges in a bit more detail later in this call. Now, for now, it's just worth noticing that increases in patenting and increases in challenges tend to go together. So the pre-expiration challenges, again, the dotted line is increasing from about 20% of drugs within a cohort to roughly half. And during this same period, we're seeing increases in really all measures of patenting, whether it's patents per drug or duration, nominal patent life, or as I've depicted here, the share of drugs that have what I describe as a low-quality patent. What I mean by that is a patent listed in the Orange Book for which no claim in the patent covers the active ingredient or the composition of matter. Now, that's not a perfect measure of patent quality, but as a generalization, patents that cover aspects of the drug other than the composition of matter tend to be less likely to be both valid and infringed by a generic product. We spend more time on the paper I've cited at the bottom of the slide with my co-author working this out in a regression setting, showing that additional patenting, particularly for these low-quality patents, tends to increase the likelihood of generic challenges. Now, why does all this matter? Why do we care about this increase in patenting, this increase in generic drug challenges, trying to get to market prior to patent expiration? Well, this sort of sets the stage for what we might think of as an increasingly tense standoff between these brand name firms that are increasingly patenting and generic drug makers on the other side that are increasingly on the attack and disproportionately attacking, I would say, these lower quality patents. Now, the consequences of this are, I think, predictable and really at the heart of what we're talking about today. One, new efforts to collude between brand and generic drug makers, which we've seen a lot of in the U.S. in the form of paper delay settlements. And more to the point here, continuing efforts by the brand name firm to exclude using the various unilateral tactics that we'll start to get into in detail next. That's all I've got.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Scott, for these very interesting perspectives from the American point of view. We are a bit behind time, but still would like to open the floor for a couple of short questions, perhaps. So. Moderator, would you please open the floor?
Thank you. If you would like to ask a question at this time, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. A voice prompt on your phone line will indicate that your line is open to ask a question. Again, please press star 1 to ask a question.
Do we have any questions from the floor?
We have no questions at this time.
Okay. Well, then let's perhaps, given that time is progressing, let's perhaps move on to the first of our case studies after after the scene has been set by our introductory presentations by Satish, Paul, and Scott, we'll have a first case study, which will be presented by Liberty. The case is called Hazel Tao and others versus GSK and BI. It's a case from South Africa. It concerns HIV/AIDS treatment and got started with a complaint about excessive prices for the drugs used in HIV/AIDS treatment. Liberty, the floor is yours.
Thanks to the organizers. This case raised the issue of whether the respondents, GSK and BI, had abused their dominant positions by charging excessive prices for their patented HIV/AIDS medicines, while also refusing to grant licenses in exchange for reasonable royalties. South Africa has the highest population of people living with HIV/AIDS of any country. This is just by way of background. In 2000, an estimated 5 to 6 million people were infected. Antiretroviral treatment is the main type of therapy available for HIV/AIDS. Although not a cure, it has been proven to be effective in combating the impact of HIV and AIDS. Whilst at the same time, the availability of antiretroviral treatment remains one of South Africa's biggest challenges. In 2002, Hazel Dow, a person living with HIV and others, filed a complaint that GSK and BI had contravened the Competition Act by charging excessive prices for their patented ARV medicines. The Commission expanded the investigation to include refusing to give competitors access to an essential facility when it is economically feasible to do so and engaging in general exclusionary conduct. At the time of the investigation, GSK held patents in Retrovo, 3TC, and Combivo, while BI held patents in NVP. The complainants sought to compel the respondents to license their ARV medicines to generic manufacturers. Moving on to the assessment of dominance and market definition, the relevant markets were the South African product markets for each specific ARV subject to the complaints using the ATC-5 classification corresponding to the market for each active ingredient. The medical evidence demonstrated that ARV medicines were not substitutable for each other. GSK had 100% market share in the sale and manufacture of AZT, the sale and manufacture of 3TC, and the sale and manufacture of Combivo, while BI had 100% market share in the manufacture and sale of NVP. Both companies had substantial market power in each of the relevant markets. GSK and BI controlled patents that enabled them to block generic competition for AZT, 3TC, Combivo, and NVP, and allowed them to charge super-competitive prices for their products. On the evaluation of excessive pricing, Section 8A of the Competition Act in South Africa prohibits a dominant firm from charging an excessive price to the detriment of consumers. The analysis compared the respondents' prices to estimates of costs and to reference prices in Brazil. Furthermore, the analysis noted that the standards for excessive pricing of essential goods are appropriately different from those of non-essential goods. Second, the evaluation of excessive pricing is different when the price of the goods is based on the value of the intellectual property. GSK and BI were alleged to have contravened the act by pricing medicines in a manner that bears no reasonable relation to the economic value of the goods and to the detriment of consumers. Based on slide 37, based on these considerations, the analysis focused on these standards. The first inquiry required a determination of the economic value of the good. The second inquiry required determining whether the prices set by the dominant firm bear a reasonable relationship to the economic value and are higher than that value. For the first inquiry, where essential goods are protected by intellectual property are at stake, the analysis concluded that a price can be presumed to be higher than the economic value if substantial numbers of people who need the medicine do not purchase it through individual or pooled incomes. This brings the inquiry to the determination of whether the price is reasonable related to the economic value despite it being higher than that value. The analysis concluded that the price of medicine that is unaffordable to those who need it bears no reasonable relationship to its economic value when it is not at the lowest possible price, consistent to giving the patentee due reward for innovation. In the present case, a competitive provision of the good was feasible. GSK and BI could have either priced their medicines to be affordable to most people or licensed their patents to competitors for a reasonable royalty. Only a tiny fraction of persons living with HIV/AIDS could afford to buy the medicines at the prices set. On the evaluation of refusal to supply, Section 8B prohibits a dominant firm from refusing to give a competitor access to an essential facility when it is economically feasible to do so. GSK and BI patents were not duplicatable. Access to GSK and BI's patents was necessary to provide goods. GSK and BI refused competitors access to their patents while it was economically feasible to do so. So the Commission found that both GSK and BI had contravened the Competition Act by charging excessive prices, refusing to grant a competitor access to an essential facility, and engaging in exclusionary conduct. However, before the Commission could refer the case to the Tribunal for Prosecution, GSK and BI decided to settle and agreed to the following conditions. They agreed to grant licenses to generic manufacturers, to permit licensees to export the relevant ARV medicines to sub-Saharan African countries. Where the licensee did not have manufacturing capability in South Africa, permit the importation of ARV medicines for the distribution in South Africa, provided all the regulatory approvals were obtained. Permit the licensees to combine the relevant ARVs with other ARV medicines and not require royalties in excess of 5% in net sales of the relevant ARVs. Moving on to slide 40, as a consequence of the settlement, GSK concluded 8 license agreements, of which six related to the South African market, and BI concluded 3 licenses. If you look at slide 41, it shows the pre and post settlement price movements. An assessment of the prices of the specific ARV subject to the complaint reveals that voluntary license agreements introduced generic competition, which has subsequently decreased the prices of these products. And as you can see, the prices in 2006 are way lower than the equivalent in 2002-2003. Again, moving on to slide 42, you can see that the prices of patented ARVs at the time of the complaint in 2002 are compared with the prices in 2006 of the same patented ARV and the cheapest available generic equivalent at the time. Again, the introduction of generic competition reduced the prices of ARVs substantially in South Africa. In conclusion, the promotion of generic competition ensured that the low cost and affordable medicines were available to HIV and AIDS sufferers. The Commission did not view IPR to be beyond competition scrutiny, and the remedies imposed required access required the originator companies to out-license their patented product to generic manufacturers. So thank you. That's it from the presentation in South Africa. However, it is important to note that because the case never went to the tribunal, it was not put through the adjudicative processes of our tribunal. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Liberty, for this highly interesting presentation on an intriguing case from South Africa. I would like to open the floor again for any questions from the audience. Operator, would you please open the floor for questions?
Thank you. If you would like to ask a question at this time, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. A voice prompt on your phone line will indicate that your line is open to ask a question. Again, please press star 1 to ask a question. We will take our first question. Please go ahead.
Oh, hello. I had a question. My name is Paul Gresky. What was the rationale that the firms offered for their pricing strategy, the originator, GSK?
Liberty?
The GSK's arguments were that they had innovated and it was a reward for their innovation. They settled not because they thought they had a weak case, but rather because the public scrutiny, they did not want to be perceived to be against the AIDS and HIV sufferers.
Yes, but you suggest that they are only able to supply a very small proportion of the total market for HIV drugs. So presumably, then wouldn't it be more profitable to lower the price slightly?
It would have been, but I'm not quite sure why they did not. They were only forced to reduce their prices when generic competition came into the market. But if you noticed something as well that was happening in slide 41, that the prices started coming down during the commission's investigation. So when the commission raised an eye on this, they began changing their pricing strategies.
Well, yes. Thank you. Thank you very much for this question and Liberty for your explanations on that. Any other question in the line right now?
We have no further questions at this time.
Okay. Well, do we have any questions from our panel?
Yes, this is Satish from the European Commission. I would like to make two points and combine them with questions, notably one on excessive pricing, one on the other one on refusal to license. Just perhaps also to add on, excessive pricing is a very difficult concept to implement in a case, and the European Commission hasn't run one in the pharma sector so far, since it seems to be very difficult to define where exactly the border to excessive pricing is passed. The question would be how to define this excessive pricing, and in particular, as you already mentioned, there is a different standard between essential and non-essential goods. How to evaluate then in this context the difference if there's really valuable intellectual property behind it or not? We already pointed to some economic explanations, but would you, for example, go and try to Well, would you try to second guess a patent authority's views, for example, on this? That would probably be going too far. I don't know, what are your views on that, Liberty?
I agree with you that excessive pricing is a difficult charge to bring, and typically competition authorities would rather bring cases along exclusionary conduct than along excessive pricing, and that there is no a single satisfactory approach or methodology to assessing excessive pricing. In this particular case, the Commission tried to look at the pricing and cost, and they also tried to benchmark prices in similar countries such as Brazil. The second point relating to the evaluation when there's a patent, it's also very difficult because when excessive price is based on an intellectual property, there are unique characteristics to prices and costs that need to be taken. For example, that because firms are selling the intellectual property goods, that they are minimally constrained by the cost of producing those goods, and they don't set their prices on demand, but rather on the supply considerations. As well, once the patent has been created, it can be copied for a little or no cost, and that makes the evaluation even more difficult from that point.
Thank you very much, Liberty, and thank you very much, Satish. I think we should move on to our second case study now, which will be presented by Ed and Natalie from the UK. This case concerns sustained release morphine, which is used for palliative care in cancer treatment. I would like to give the floor over to Ed and Natalie to give us an introduction to their case.
Thank you, Marcus. What I intend to do is to firstly outline some background to the case, and then pass over to Natalie, who will look at some market definition and dominance issues that arose in the case. And then I'll come back to summarize both the exclusionary and the exploitative abuses that we were found in our decision and that were upheld on appeal. The reason we chose this case, I think, is essentially because it highlights one of the issues that Jean-Paul Brankin raised in his introductory note, which is the very interesting demand structure in pharmaceutical markets, in particular the split between the consumer, the patient, in other words, the purchaser, which in this case is the National Health Service of the UK, and the decision maker, which is the doctor, or in this case, there may be splits within the decision maker itself between the specialist, the hospital prescriber, and the GP, the normal community prescriber as well. And what I think this case highlights is that how dominant firms, pharmaceutical firms, might use this unusual demand structure to develop pricing strategies which effectively foreclose the market to new entry. So to give you a bit of background, NAP Pharmaceuticals was the first company in the UK to launch a sustained-release morphine product in 1980. And sustained-release morphine is a strong opioid analgesic which is used to treat moderate and severe pain, particularly in cancer patients. And it releases pain relief over a sustained period of time, hence its name. So NAP had grown to about 95% of the total market with its product MST, and it had a patent on its formulation between 1980 and 1992. And following expiry of the patent, a number of big pharmaceutical companies tried to enter with Me Too branded generic products, i.e. these are generic pharmaceutical equivalent products, but which have a brand name, they're not under a generic name. But in each case, the new entrants were forced to leave, and largely as a result of NAP's pricing behaviour, which we'll come to in a minute. I think the key background to this case lies in the distinct segments of the market. The market is broadly divided into two parts. The largest part is, we're on slide four, by the way, here. The largest part is the community segment, which takes up about 90% of the market. And this is prescriptions for patients that are under care of their GP, i.e. at home or otherwise in the community. The remainder of the market, which is 10%, is the hospital segment. And that comprises hospitals that either purchase their pharmaceuticals by competitive tender, which are organized on a regional basis, or directly from the manufacturer themselves. I think the key point is, and this comes up in a lot of pharmaceutical markets, is that the GPs themselves are quite inert in terms of their prescribing behavior. They don't respond particularly to variations in price or price relative prices for new drugs. They're relatively price insensitive. So it's very difficult for new entrants, particularly in the case of oral sustained release morphine, to enter the community segment of the market directly. And to get their products prescribed instead of MST. In effect, doctors, GPs in the community considered MST to be the gold standard. They were very well aware of its efficacy and effectiveness. They'd prescribed it before, they had experience with it, and it was very hard to get them to switch. Hospitals, on the other hand, were a different matter. Because hospitals were price sensitive, and it was possible to win contracts to hospitals. The other thing that was very important about hospitals, and this is again, I think, reflected in other drugs markets, is that they provide a reputation effect, that specialists in hospitals prescribing drugs will be a very key factor in establishing the reputation of a particular drug in the community. And this goes then to GPs, who will see that these specialists have prescribed this new drug, and then they will feel themselves more comfortable over time to prescribe that drug themselves, and they will learn about its effectiveness, etc., etc. So hospitals are a key strategic gateway into the market, possibly in this case the only gateway into the market for new entrants. And it is that background to the market which in effect describes how the abuse was framed in this case. But before we get to that, I'll ask Natalie to discuss some of the issues in relation to market definition and dominance.
Thanks. So now slide 48, looking at market definition. As Ed mentioned, this case touched on many of the issues that Satish and Jean-Paul spoke about in their presentations. And our starting point was, again, the ATC level 3 classification, but we quickly found that there was a narrower market. So, as Ed said, there is a split between the consumer, the decision maker, which in this case is the hospital, consultant, or the GP, and the purchaser. And in fact, this meant that the community doctors were not very price sensitive, whilst the hospital consultants were. And really, this led to two issues. First, we have complex incentives, which the dominant firm was able to exploit. And secondly, carrying out a traditional SNP test could produce quite narrow market definitions. And it was an interesting question to see how this could be taken into account when assessing market definition. So we therefore looked at several things when defining the market. The first thing that we looked at was the prescribing guidelines and GP surveys, and these indicated that on the demand side there was actually little substitutability between sustained release morphine and other types of morphine or sustained release and non-morphine products. We then looked at the comparison of community prices of various morphine and non-morphine products, and this showed that the price of morphine non-morphine products was unlikely to constrain the price of sustained-release morphine, as they were 2 to 3 times higher than MST for comparable doses. So because of the split between the consumer decision-maker and purchaser and the fact that the community was not necessarily price-sensitive, we looked not only at pricing data and event analysis, but also at non-pricing factors such as the prescribing guidelines and GP surveys. And finally, to note that on the supply side, we also found that morphine and non-morphine products were not considered to be effective substitutes. So thinking about dominance on the next slide, NAPS did manage to maintain its market share of around 90% despite the fact that its product was off-patent and that other entrants had come into the market. There were barriers to entry, such as regulation, which meant that it would take any new entrant a considerable length of time to enter. But the main reason for NAPS dominance was that NAPS had strong first-mover advantages, particularly as GPs are often reluctant to experiment with new products that have not been directly experienced. So as Ed said, in order to overcome NAPS first mover advantage, the new brand needed to establish a reputation for efficacy in the eyes of the community practitioners. And this reputation, as Ed mentioned, was difficult to establish as it depends on, to a large degree on GPs having had direct experience of the brand. One interesting factor in the UK is that we have what's called a pharmaceutical price regulation scheme. And NAPS argued that it was not possible for it to be dominant in any relevant market because of the existence of this scheme. It claimed that this scheme prevented it from being able to abuse any dominance it might enjoy, at least in respect of the abuses alleged in this particular case. The PPRS scheme is basically a voluntary scheme that operates in the UK to regulate the profit that companies may make from their sales of branded prescription medicines supplied to the National Health Service. And it sets a limit on the rate of return that a company can earn on its sales of branded prescription medicines to the NHS or the National Health System. And the profit limit is applied across all the products that a company sells to the NHS and is not applied to each product individually. Therefore, the OFT felt and was upheld on appeal that this would not prevent NAPS from being dominant. And finally, the issue of buyer power was examined in this case. There was a question of whether the National Health Service could have buyer power. And in theory, yes, but in practice, as explained, the fact that there is this split between the consumer and decision maker and purchaser, it meant that the NHS was not able to leverage any theoretical power that it might have had. Turning to the chart in slide 50, we can see how the conduct that NAPS carried out actually affected prices. So this chart compares hospital and community prices. And following the expiry of the MST patent in August 1992, the price of the MST tablets to the community remained relatively stable at around 12.5% discount from trade prices up to the period May 2000. But what you see is that the discounts to hospitals increased dramatically over the period following the launch by a Me Too product in October 1991. And you can see in the chart the widening differential of the MST 100 milligrams between the hospital and community segments of the market. And it's interesting to note that the picture was very similar for 10 milligrams, 30 milligrams, and 60 milligrams strengths of MST. So if I hand back to Ed, he will talk about the exclusionary and exploitative abuses.
So just briefly to summarise the slides 51 and 52, and I think it's clear from the table that the chart that Natalie just described, the primary abuse related to pricing below cost to the hospital segment, and in the sense that the hospital segment was the key strategic gateway into the market. We had some measurement issues here, but what we found was that in many cases prices were below the direct costs of manufacture. Just basically the raw materials and labour. We were pretty confident that we met the price below ABC test. But what made it particularly compelling was also that a lot of these discounts were offered in return for exclusive contracts for a period of 3 to 4 years that NAPS basically targeted hospitals or regions where competitors had got a foothold in, and then offered exclusivity over 3 to 4 years. So that was in addition to the predatory pricing. One of the interesting issues on appeal in this case was whether or not NAPS was in fact pricing below ABC, given that any sales to the hospitals would lead to follow-on sales in the community. In other words, if a patient was prescribed a drug in a hospital, they were likely then to go out into the community and be prescribed the same drug. So that could argue that, in effect, you would also have to factor in the follow-on sales to any pricing below cost assessment. We discovered, in effect, that any follow-on sales weren't mechanical, i.e. that the companies couldn't depend or couldn't predict whether or not there would be follow-on sales, particularly for new entrants, because GPs would frequently switch them back to the NAC product, given its reputation. We also found an excessive pricing abuse in the community segment. I think there's two things which are important to say about this. The first thing is that this abuse was very much linked to the exclusionary abuse, in the sense that we found excessive pricing as a kind of adjunct, if you like, to the exclusionary abuse, i.e. the only reason that excessive prices could be maintained in the community was because of the exclusion over time in the hospital segment. And we found excessive pricing on the basis of a number of comparisons. Comparisons with competitor prices and margins, comparisons with export prices that NAC had, comparisons with the patient protection price, i.e. the fact that the price hadn't come down in the community segment, if anything at all, since the expiry of the patent, and the fact that NAC's margins in the community were still at the level, more or less, of the patent period. What we didn't do was a whole life cost assessment, and that was an issue that came up on appeal too. So that's as much as we wanted to summarise now, but I'd be happy to take questions.
Thank you very much, Natalie and Ed, for this fascinating case highlighting the competition issues that can arise in a highly regulated health market. Thank you for that, and I would like to open the floor for any questions.
Thank you. If you would like to ask a question at this time, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. A voice prompt on your phone line will indicate that your line is open to ask a question. Again, please press star 1 to ask a question. We will take our first question. Please go ahead.
Yes, hello.
Yes, hello.
This is Wilko Töllner from Germany. I have got a question with regard to the market definition. You mentioned all the criteria you used, and also that you had this particular demand structure in the pharmaceutical area. I wondered, from the demand side, which side did you take into account with regard to market definition, the GPs or the National Health Service or the patient himself? That would be interesting. And related to that, you mentioned with regard to the dominance issue, the question of buyer power. And you examined the National Health Service, and as I understood, you found no buyer power. Here in Germany, we have a tender procedure with regard to prescription drugs, which means that the health insurance companies tender specific drugs or pharmaceuticals, and then the doctor prescribes the specific drug, not under its brand name, but the use for the drugs, and the pharmacist has to look up if there's any tender from this specific insurance company in force, and he has to hand over the specific drug. So in such a scenario, you could come to a certain buyer power. And my question is it organized differently in Great Britain, and would you come to a different result in another scenario?
If I could answer that, probably I'll take the two questions together, because I think they're linked once you understand how the UK system works. So first of all, from the demand side perspective, we did look at what the GPs were prescribing rather than the patient's preference, because it was actually the GP who made the decision. The way that the prescribing works, in the hospital sector, there is a tender system that they tender for the drugs in terms of pricing. And in the community sector, when the GP writes the prescription, if they write down the name of the brand, then the pharmacist absolutely has to prescribe the brand, even if there was a generic equivalent that was much cheaper. Mm-hmm. If the GP, on the other hand, were to write down a prescription for the generic drug, then the pharmacist can choose to give or to prescribe whichever drug is the cheapest one, so long as they are absolutely equivalent. So what we were finding in this case is that NAP was obviously targeting the hospitals in order to try and ensure that the hospital pharmacy would always prescribe NAP's drug because it was the cheapest for them. And when the patient then went out into the community, the GP would look and see that the patient was on NAP's drug and not like to change it. And on the prescription, they would write down NAP's drug rather than the generic equivalent. And the community pharmacist would then be forced to actually give the patient NAP's drug rather than the cheapest drug available. And in that sense, because of the split there, we didn't feel that the NHS actually had buyer power.
Oh, yes. Thank you for that clarification.
Thank you very much, Wilco, for the question, and Natalie for explaining the approach in the UK. Before moving on to our next case study, I would just like to call on Brad and give him the opportunity to add to this if he likes.
This is Brad Albert at the U.S. Federal Trade Commission. I can briefly mention a recent U.S. decision involving product market definition in the hospital sector, because I think it's interesting because it highlights what Ed and Natalie were talking about the complicated way in which these pharmaceutical markets work. The U.S. had brought the Federal Trade Commission had brought a case against the pharmaceutical company Lundbeck for acquiring a product called Neoprofen. And Neoprofen was used to treat a serious heart condition in premature babies. At the time of the acquisition, Lundbeck owned a product called Indocin, which at that point was the only product that was approved to treat this condition. So with the acquisition, Lundbeck, in fact, owned the only two products out there that could be used to treat this very serious medical condition. The products, because it involved premature babies, the products were sold only to hospitals, and the primary issue in the case was whether the two products were in the same product market, because, of course, if they were in the same product market, then the acquisition under U.S. law would be illegal. Lundbeck argued that they were not, that they were, in fact, in separate product markets, and the court agreed with Lundbeck. And the primary reason that the court agreed with Lundbeck's argument that they were in separate product markets was because the court concluded that the relevant consumer were the specialists who chose which product to give to the infant, either Neoprofen or Indocin, and discounted the fact that it was the hospitals that actually paid for the drugs when they purchased it from the companies, and the court concluded that the doctors themselves were not price sensitive and didn't care about what price the drug was offered, but instead were fixed in their preferences for one drug over the other. And as a result, the court concluded that the two products were in separate product markets. And I think that this case highlights for us and for everybody the challenges in bringing in defining product market in the pharmaceutical sector because of this disconnect between those who prescribe the product and those who pay for the product. Just as a side note, the FTC has filed a notice of its intent to appeal the decision, so we'll see what ends up happening.
Thank you very much, Brad. Given the time, I think we should move on to our final case study now, which will be on issues of life cycle management. I would like to give the floor again to Brad, and Brad, ask you to give us an insight into the issues that arise with life cycle management in the pharmaceutical sector. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Marcus. So, life cycle management is a very broad topic that we could spend a lot of time talking about, and we've already touched upon it a little bit earlier today. I'm going to focus on a particular type of life cycle management that is sometimes referred to as product hopping, and take a look at a case involving Abbott Laboratories and a drug called Tricor. To take a step back just at the beginning, life cycle management, broadly defined, is really any action that a branded company takes to preserve its market share in the face of competition from either a brand or a generic. Many of these actions, maybe even most of these actions, are not only legal, but are beneficial because they bring new products to market. They may bring developed or new uses or indications for existing products. They may find new ways to combine existing products together into one pill to provide new benefits. So the issue, the more difficult issue is to think about is highlighted by the narrower definition, which are, you know, are there circumstances in which a unilateral action by a branded company can be exclusionary and anti-competitive if the change is done primarily to thwart and prevent automatic substitution of a generic at the pharmacy. To understand that, I think we'll take a step back a little bit and talk about the U.S. regulatory structure because it's an important context. For what I mean there. So in the United States, the Food and Drug Administration, which is charged with approving drugs, deems products to be therapeutically equivalent if it meets two criteria. First, the generic drug has to be bioequivalent, which means it essentially does the same thing in the body as the branded drug. And in addition, it needs to be pharmaceutically equivalent, which means it not only has to have the same active ingredient, but it has to be the same dosage form. So if the branded drug is a capsule, it also the generic drug has to be a capsule. It has to be provided in the same. The route of administration needs to be the same. The strength and concentration of the drug needs to be the same. If a drug is considered to be, if the FDA finds a generic drug to be therapeutically equivalent, then the system in the U.S. is a little bit different than the system that Natalie was describing with respect to the U.K. system. Under the various state laws in the United States, a pharmacist may automatically substitute prescriptions for the brand to a therapeutically equivalent generic. So if a prescription is written for the branded product, the pharmacist can dispense the therapeutically equivalent generic without contacting the physician, and in fact, the pharmacy has the incentive to do so because it makes more money dispensing the generic version of the product. If we take a look at the next slide, you'll see what happens typically when a therapeutically equivalent generic is introduced into the market, and this is as a result of the automatic substitution system that's in place. This is an example taken actually from about 10 years ago. The black line shows the uptake of the generic version. The red line shows the erosion of the branded prescriptions. And you can see the very rapid substitution to the generic version. After just 4 months, the generic version had more sales. Since this is an old example, this conversion to the generic actually occurs much quicker in today's market, and we can see over 80% of the sales going from the brand to the generic in just the first month. So what can the branded company do to try to avoid this rapid erosion of its sales? And that's what the next slide talks about, various life cycle strategies. It can change the formulation, so it can combine two different active ingredients, which is the example of Catawit. It can change the method of delivery. So, for example, Avcon was a case that the FTC had brought a couple of years ago, and it involved a oral contraceptive pill. The branded company in that case had decided that instead of dispensing the pill as a pill, it was going to make it a chewable version. And so it was changing the dosage form, and making it a chewable version would eliminate the ability for automatic substitution. What we're going to talk about now is changing the strength of the product, and that's the Tricor example, which is indicated here as a change in formulation. So if we move to the next slide, which should be slide 59, the Tricor example is one that this illustrates the product hopping strategy. So Tricor is a drug that's used to treat high cholesterol. It is made by Abbott Laboratories, and the strategy that Abbott devised was that it would change the dosage form and strength of the product before a generic was able to get approved by the FDA and gain traction in the market. And so what ended up happening was that the generics were trying to enter and had to keep trying to catch up to the new formulation of the product that was introduced by Abbott because it needed to have the same formulation, same strength, in order to be automatically substituted at the pharmacy level. And Abbott took its product hopping strategy to an extreme. Not only did it make the changes to the formulation, but it then took various other steps to try to make sure that its switch to the new formulation was effective. And so what it did was it pulled the old product off the market. And not only pulled the old product off the market, it made sure that any existing pills of the old product that were out there in the distribution network were also eliminated. So it bought those back, it destroyed its inventory, and it also deleted the code for the old formulation from the national drug data file, which basically meant that it took the old product out of the computer systems so that when so that it wouldn't even be recognized. The generic wouldn't even be recognized as a generic. So if we move to the next slide, this is it's an attempt to try to explain or show exactly what Abbott was trying to do and what it accomplished. We'll start at the bottom left-hand corner. It shows that Abbott introduced a 200 milligram product in 1998. Just about a year and a half later, Teva, which is a large generic company, had filed an ANDA, which is a generic application, to get approval for its generic version of Tricor. In the United States, after that happened, since Teva was challenging some patents that existed on Abbott's Tricor product, there is a stay of FDA approval for 30 months while the patent issues are being litigated. During that stay, so when Teva could not get approval, if you jump up to the next line, Abbott launched a new version of Tricor in a 160-milligram strength, and they also changed from a capsule to a tablet version, and at that point withdrew the old version from the market. So when Teva finally was able to get approval in March of 2002, there was no market for the 200 milligram version. Teva tried to introduce its now approved generic version, and was totally unsuccessful, and was able to obtain none of the market conversion that is typical of introducing a generic version. So what did Teva do? Well, it filed an ANDA, an application for the new version, the 160-milligram version of Tricor. And what happened was just repeat the same process. Abbott filed a new application for a revised version of its Tricor product, this time in the 145-milligram version. And before Teva could get final approval of its 160-milligram, Abbott had launched its 145-milligram version. Teva gets final approval. There's no market left for the 160-milligram. And the result is Abbott maintains its market for Tricor. At this point, you know, even today, in 2010, 11 years after Teva initially filed its generic application, there is still no generic version of Tricor that's on the market in the United States. So Abbott has been successful over an 11-year period of time in staving off generic competition by modifying the dosage strength of its products. So not surprisingly, in a situation like this, there were antitrust actions that were brought, in this case by Teva, as well as various state attorney general's offices and some other purchasers of pharmaceutical products, including health plans and others. And Abbott had moved to dismiss that case, arguing that its unilateral conduct in bringing new products to market could not be anti-competitive, particularly if the plaintiffs did not prove that the new product was no better than the original version. The court disagreed with Abbott and denied the motion to dismiss, and found that plaintiffs are not required to prove that the new formulations were absolutely no better than the prior version, but rather plaintiffs show that the anti-competitive harm from the formulation changes, that harm will be weighed against any benefits presented by defendants. And if we move on to the next slide, on 62, we can see a similar expression of a standard that's given by some leading antitrust scholars in the United States, talking about product hopping. Seems clearly to be an effort to game the rather intricate FDA rules, where the patentee is making a product change with no technological benefit solely in order to delay competition. Such a change could qualify as predatory product change if it lacks substantial medical benefit. Turn us to the next slide. This is a cartoon that ran some years ago in the United States, and I think it's just a fun cartoon. It pokes some fun at what drug companies sometimes do to change their new product. This is essentially what Hovenkamp and Lemley, I think, are referring to. They're asking, you know, one of the questions to be asked is the new product simply putting antlers on a goose and calling it a moose, or is the new product really something different, something that provides something to consumers? What happened in the Abbott-Teva situation? Well, the case never did go to a final decision. Right as the trial was beginning, Abbott ended up settling with the generics and paying more than $184 million U.S. dollars. So we don't know what the, you know, other than the motion to dismiss decision, we don't know what the courts would have found. There is an interesting, and I'll just touch very briefly on another case that involved a product switch, this time involving a switch from AstraZeneca's switch from Prilosec to Nexium. But in this case, Astra, unlike Abbott, did not withdraw Prilosec from the market. In fact, at the time that it introduced Nexium, Prilosec was still a very, very large product, multi-billion-dollar product. There were some private actions that were brought. The outcome was different in this case, and the court did dismiss the case on on a 12B6 motion, which meant that the court found that there was no legal basis for the antitrust claim. And essentially what the court did was pointed to the fact that that AstraZeneca had left the product on the market, therefore there was no reduction in choice for consumers, and that in order to make an antitrust case, there needs to be some reduction in competition. So I think since we are running past the time, I will just end on just briefly noting that the FTC has not, in fact, brought any cases at this point directly challenging a product switch.
Thank you, Brad, for this fascinating perspective on the vaccine strategies of life cycle management. I would now like to open the floor for questions relating, of course, primarily to the last case study that we heard, but also to any of the other preceding case studies in case any question that you may still have had on your mind was cut short earlier. So please feel free to speak up now. So if I could ask the operator to open the floor for questions.
Thank you. As a reminder, if you wish to ask a question, please press star 1. We will take our first question. Please go ahead.
Hello?
Yes, please go ahead.
Hi, you're speaking to Avius. I'm calling from the South African Competition Commission. I just had a question for the Net Pharmaceuticals case study.
Okay.
My question was, given the fact that pricing is so different for patent and generic products, there's a huge discrepancy. Usually the generic products bring down the price in terms of the patented product. How did you go about applying the SNP test in that situation?
Well, I think as Natalie mentioned, there are some questions about how you apply a SNP test in pharmaceutical markets directly. And I think it was Sean Paul mentioned at the beginning, there were some issues on the AstraZeneca case about whether or not a direct SNP test was appropriate to measure the degree of competition between rival products and whether or not ultimately for assessing the relevant market. But I think in a sense it's a bit tricky with the generic issue because clearly, there is direct competition. If you look at price charts after generic entry in most products, and it was the case in that with the hospital segment, where there is switching, and that switching is mandated through the system of prescribing, as in the sort of the pharmacies being able to switch to a generic product, where that switching occurs, and there is quite clearly a high degree of price competition, and you see prices coming down very quickly after generic entry. And I suppose that, you know, that is obviously relevant for from the perspective of market definition. I think where you have price insensitivity in the pharmaceutical market, I don't think that means the price is irrelevant to the assessment of relevant market, because I think even in situations of price insensitivity, you would still see some relationship, or should see some relationship, between prices of competing products, even if that might be slightly muted by the inertia of the GP. So I don't think it makes pricing data irrelevant at all to the assessment of the relevant market. I'm not sure if that's helpful, but that's where we got to. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Perhaps one more question from the floor.
As a reminder, if you wish to ask a question, please press star 1.
Well, if there's no more question from the floor, I'd like to turn back to our panel and just ask our panelists whether there are any remarks, thoughts, and additional comments that they would like to make. Scott, maybe do you?
Yeah, great. This is Scott Hemphill. Brad, I was really I was quite struck by the quotation in Abbott, providing that even if there's some benefit, we might still have some liability. And I just wanted to follow up if you had any thoughts about how we might go about weighing, the bitter and the sweet that you might see sort of bundled together in one of these switches. It reminds me a little bit of a statement by an FTC commissioner a few years back. I think this was Sheila Anthony, who was talking about a case. I guess it's a bit like the Prilosec to Nexium switch. It was a next-generation version of Prozac, and Lilly, which makes Prozac, was thinking about buying the rights to the next-generation version, the single enantiomer version, that was being the rights to which were held by another company, Sepracor. And it feels like a product switching case to me. The commission in the end decided not to act, and Commissioner Anthony offered in a speech, some thoughts about why the FTC might not want to move forward in a case like this. And it seems like she emphasized there the idea that, you don't really want to second guess the decisions of doctors and patients if they, choose to shift from one drug to the other. Now, that's not really an issue with Tricor, since Abbott did the job for us. They took the old drug, entirely off the market, and in sort of Byzantine and elaborate ways withdrew it from the market. But in, the mine run of cases where we don't have that kind of extreme behavior as in Tricor, just wondering if you think, the comments of Commissioner Anthony give us a hint about how the FTC thinks about this, or just more generally how we should, try to think about how to go about the weighing that Abbott suggests.
I think that's a great question and a very difficult question, and is probably a reason why you don't see many product hopping cases brought, even though it does seem like in the Tricor case it's an extreme example of what a company can do by making minor tweaks to the formulation. I mean, I think that a product hopping case is if an agency were to bring a case like that, it would need to have some pretty significant facts, such as those that we saw in Tricor. You would need to see a company, perhaps withdrawing the product from the market entirely, so that it eliminated this choice, so that doctors didn't have the choice of prescribing the old version, so that you saw, because in that case there is no market test. Because the brand has eliminated that choice, and perhaps even in Tricor there were allegations that the newer versions of the newer formulations of Tricor, Abbott actually relied on the same clinical studies to get approval from the FDA as they had with the older version. So that in and of itself suggests that the newer version of the product may not be much different at all than the older version of the product. But I think without facts like that, it's a tough thing to balance.
Right.
Well, thank you very much. To wrap up, perhaps allow me one last question to the panel, and that is whether. The differences in market structure or market setup that we've heard about, for instance, this important issue of the level and extent of state intervention in the pharmaceuticals market, do these differences justify different approaches to market definition in different jurisdictions? Would anyone from the panel like to give their thoughts on that? How about Jean-Paul?
Well,
I'll offer a thought, which is this, that if the big concern in this area is that over-enforcement may lead to chilling innovation, then that concern will be much greater, it seems to me, at least in a lot of existing cases and for conditions which are prevalent across all jurisdictions in the jurisdictions where the money is really made. And that, at the moment, is developed countries like the US, Europe, and to a lesser extent, perhaps, Japan. So it may be that markets outside those areas have rather greater freedom to take some risks in terms of offsetting incentives to innovate by intervening. So there's a legitimate question to be asked, I think, about whether the kind of intervention that we heard in the first case study in South Africa would be as legitimate in another jurisdiction. I could go on, but I think I've made the point.
Okay, well, thank you very much. I think we've seen that regulatory regimes for pharmaceuticals and by extension also the conditions for applying competition law to pharmaceutical markets differ significantly from one jurisdiction to the next. But still, there is a lot to be learned for us in our individual jurisdictions by looking over the fence and by learning from our fellow jurisdictions within the ICN. I think today's teleseminar has been extremely insightful for me, at least. I would like to thank our experts on the panel for the excellent presentations that we have heard and for giving us a glimpse into the specific enforcement issues in their jurisdictions. And I would also like to thank you for your readiness and enthusiasm in joining us on this teleseminar and in working with us in preparing the event. My thanks also go to our audience for joining us, for dialing into this teleseminar. Thank you very much, and thank you for your active participation. I'm very sorry if, due to the limited time that we have, perhaps one or the other possibility for speaking up had to be cut short. So sorry for that. The panelists' commitment to the teleseminars and the audience involvement is, of course, the lifeblood of any conference, and this is particularly true for a teleconference. I would also like to thank very much Cynthia and Jan for organizing this teleseminar, for organizing the program and getting all our speakers on board and for getting all the logistics right. So thank you very much to both of you, Cynthia and Jan. With this, I would like to say goodbye and hand over to my co-chair of the Unilateral Conduct Working Group, Randy Tritel. Randy?
Thank you, Marcus. Let me just add my thanks to the speakers and to Marcus for leading us through an illuminating discussion. You've provided very valuable insights for the enforcers to consider in looking at the issues and investigations in this sector, and I hope the NGAs on the call have also gained a better understanding of how the agencies think about the issues that arise in these cases. If you have ideas for future teleseminars, we welcome your suggestions and also on the format of these programs. We'd very much like your feedback, positive or negative, on today's program. It would also be helpful if you could let us know if there was more than one person on your line so we can gauge the interest of the audience and the number of listeners. You can find our coordinates on the ICN website, where you can also reach out to Jan Lohberg or Cynthia Lagdameo at the addresses listed on the ICN's website. Finally, I'll just mention that the working group is drafting a workbook on unilateral conduct analysis, and we look forward to seeing many of you in Brussels for our workshop on unilateral conduct on December 2nd and 3rd. Note that registration has been extended through the end of this week. So on behalf of Marcus and myself, thanks again for joining us, and we welcome your continued involvement in our work and our programs. Goodbye.
That will conclude today's conference call. Thank you for your participation, ladies and gentlemen. You may now disconnect.